Rodney Stone by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized for radio in four parts by Constance Cox, with Sean Arnold as Rodney Stone, Henry Stamper, Charlotte Mitchell, and John Rye. Rodney Stone, Part 3.
And now the day of the great fight began to approach. Even the imminent outbreak of war and the renewed threats of Napoleon were secondary things in the eyes of the sportsman, and the sportsman in those days made a large half of the population. In the club of the patrician and the plebeian gin shop, in the coffee house of the merchant or the barrack of the soldier, in London or the provinces, the same question was interesting the whole nation. Every West Country coach brought up word of the fine condition of Crabb Wilson, who had returned to his own native air for his training and was known to be under the immediate care of Captain Barclay, the expert. On the other hand, although my uncle had not yet named his man, there was no doubt amongst the public that Jim was to be his nominee, and the report of his physique and of his performance found him many backers. On the whole, however, the betting was in favour of Wilson, for Bristol and the West Country stood by him to a man, whilst London opinion was divided. 3-2 were to be had on Wilson at any West End club 2 days before the battle. I had twice been down to Crawley to see Jim in his training quarters, where I found him undergoing the severe regimen which was usual. From early dawn until nightfall he was running, jumping, striking a bladder which swung upon a bar, or sparring with his formidable trainer. His eyes shone and his skin glowed with exuberant health, and he was so confident of success that my own misgivings vanished as I watched his gallant bearing and listened to his quiet and cheerful words. The afternoon of the day before the fight found my uncle in the dainty sanctum of his Jermyn Street house. He was clad, I remember, in his flowing brocade dressing gown, as was his custom before he set off for his club, and his foot was extended upon a stool.
I'm sorry, sir.
Not your fault. Oh, push the boot on hard.
Dr. Abernethy did say, sir, that until your gout is better...
Gout or no gout, I go to Crawley today. Oh, confounded man. Am I expected to miss my own fight tomorrow? Now, put the other boot on.
Oh, yes, sir.
Yes, it's better. Now, the moment I stand on it... Oh, Abernethy's a fool. Have our things packed and ready. We shall dine first and set out about 7.
Yes, sir. Oh, good afternoon, Master Rodney.
Nephew. Did you give me orders at the stables?
Yes, sir. They're sending the curricle round early this evening.
Good, good. I've reserved beds at the George at Crawley for both of us. I understand the crush will exceed anything ever known.
So I heard yesterday, sir, when I was there.
When you were there? Do I understand you to mean that you've been to Crawley?
Yes, sir.
For what purpose?
To visit Jim at his training quarters.
In spite of what I said to you?
I know you'd like me to give up my friendship with Jim, sir, but I'm afraid I must disappoint you.
Oh, well, well. I suppose it's your misfortune not to have come under me influence sooner. We cannot make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, can we? If you'll pardon the somewhat uncomplimentary reference to yourself, nephew.
Freely, sir. I've always been conscious of your kindness to me.
Tell me, nephew. Is your friend fulfilling the promise he showed?
Jem Belcher's very pleased with him, sir, and I know Jim will fight until he drops.
What? Till he wins, I hope. I wagered rather more than I should care to lose on this fight. And I hear Sir Lothian Hume has been betting very heavily on his man.
But I thought he was greatly in debt, sir.
So he is. If he should lose this fight to me, he'll be in very deep waters indeed.
Excuse me, Sir Charles.
Yes.
There's a person here to see you.
Now, you know I never see anybody until my dressing is complete. Tell him to go away.
But he won't, sir. He pushed open the door.
Pushed open the door? Well, why didn't you push him out again?
Oh, he's not the sort of person...
Show me in your master, my man, or it'll be the worse for you.
Well, that sounds like War, the prize fighter.
That's right, Sir Charles. Tis me. Bill War, landlord of the Three Tuns, and the gamest man on the list, until my flesh caught up with me.
What the deuce do you want, War, charging in this manner?
I've come to tell you something mighty important, Sir Charles. And it's between man and man.
What? Oh, well, you may go, Lorimer.
Yes, sir.
Now, what is it?
'Tis information, Sir Charles. Information as is worth a lot of money.
I see. You want to be paid for what you know.
That's right.
You should know me well enough to know I don't buy things on trust. If your news is of service to me, you shan't be the loser by it.
Oh, well, that's fair enough, Governor. We'll let it stand like that.
But what have you got to say?
Your man, Jim Harrison, fights Crab Wilson of Gloucester at Crawley Down tomorrow.
Yes, yes, I know that.
Well, you're wrong, Master. I don't think he will fight.
What? What the devil are you saying, Moore? Nephew, do you know anything of this?
No.
Is he crying off at the last moment?
Oh, wait a minute, Gov. I ain't saying he's got cold feet or he don't want to fight.
Then what?
I'm saying that come tomorrow, Jim Harrison won't be fighting because he won't be able to.
What? But you must have some reason for saying such a thing. Oh, for God's sake, man, come to the point.
You remember Joe Burke, sir, as your man knocked out at the Wagon and Horse?
Yes, of course.
Well, he come into my pub last night with three of the biggest rogues in London. There was Red Ike, as was warned off the ring, and Fighting Yusuf, as had sell his mother for a 7 shilling bit. And
get on with your story.
Oh, well, they'd had just about as much as they could carry, so I showed them into the parlour, not wanting to lose my licence through any trouble.
Yes, yes.
But they was laughing, fit to kill themselves, so, well, I guess there was something in the wind, especially when I heard Red Ike was ready to put up a fiver that there'd never be a fight at all.
Did you hear anything definite?
In a minute, Gov, in a minute.
Oh.
Well, I gives them what they ordered, and then I slips out under the private bar and puts me ear to the shutter. I could hear what they said, plain as if I was sitting at their table.
Yes, yes, go on.
That's poor pay for the chance of a rope, says Red Ike. Rope be hanged, says Yusuf. If two of you own down, I'll break his arm with me cudgel. We'll have earned our money, and we don't risk more than 6 months' jug.
Break his arm?
Quiet, Rodney. When were they to leave for Crawley?
Oh, well, they never said for certain. But I heard Ike say that so long as they reached the George afore it closed, they could work it.
Well, it's now after 3. We've every chance to beat them. Rodney,
sir,
send Lorimer round to the stables. I want the curricle at once.
Yes, Uncle.
You heard no names mentioned.
Well, they didn't mention Jim Harrison's name, sir. But if you want any proof it's him they meant, I can tell you the betting against him has risen to 10-1.
What? It was 3s before. Somebody must be laying heavily against my man.
Well, maybe the party has wants him out of the way, sir.
Yeah.
Lorimer's gone to the stable, sir.
Thank you, nephew. Well, I won't detain you any further, War. You shan't be the loser by this, I promise.
Sir.
Ah.
Oh, just a friendly word of advice, Governor.
Huh?
If I was you, I'd take my pistols with me.
Who could have put them up to this, sir?
Someone who has a great deal of money at stake.
But if Jim can't fight, the match will be null and void.
No, no. You forget the terms of our wager. Play or pay. If my man doesn't enter the ring at 10 o'clock tomorrow, I pay mistake to my opponent.
You think Sir Lothian has hired these men?
I know he has. He's desperate for money and heavily in debt. If I can prove this is his doing...
The curricle's just coming, sir.
Ah, good. Get me driving things.
There is one hope, sir. Jem Belcher's with him. Well, surely he and Jim will be a match for those four.
Belcher may not always be by his side. They'll wait for a time and he's alone. But let me only fight him safe and sound, and I'll never lose sight of him until I see him in the ring. I have a great deal at stake.
So have I, sir.
You?
My friend, sir.
Oh. Oh, yes, I'd forgotten. You have an eccentricity after all, nephew. You're a faithful friend, and that's rare enough in our circles.
You're driving things.
Ah, thank you, Lorimer. Well, it won't be a nightmare drive for you today, nephew. I fear we shall find the roads blocked with traffic long before we reach Crawley. Just let's hope we may still be in time.
My uncle's fears as to our being blocked upon the road were only too well founded, for after we passed Reigate, there was such a procession of every sort of vehicle that I believe for the whole 8 miles there was not a horse whose nose was further than a few feet from the back of the curricle or barouche in front. every road leading from London had contributed its stream of four-in-hands, gigs and mounted sportsmen, until the whole Brighton Highway was choked from ditch to ditch with a laughing, singing, shouting throng, all flowing in the same direction. No man who looked upon that motley crowd could deny that, for good or evil, the love of the ring was confined to no class, but was a national peculiarity deeply seated in the English nature. There I saw statesmen and soldiers, noblemen and lawyers, farmers and squires, with roughs of the East End and yokels of the shires, all toiling along with the prospect of a night of discomfort before them, on the chance of seeing a fight which might, for all that they knew, be decided in a single round. A more cheery and hearty set of people could not be imagined, and the chaff flew about as thick as the dust clouds, while at every wayside inn the landlord and the drawers would be out with trays of foam-headed tankards to moisten those importunate throats. At Kimberham Bridge the carriage lamps were all lit, and it was wonderful where the road curved downwards before us to see this writhing serpent with the golden scales crawling before us in the darkness. And then, at last, we saw the huge Crawley elm looming before us in the gloom, and there was the broad village street, with the glimmer of the cottage windows and the high front of the old George Inn, glowing from every door and pane and crevice, in honour of the noble company who were to sleep within that night.
There you are, gentlemen. Bowl of punch for you to drink success that young Jim Harrison is.
Thank you.
You're breaking your rule, Jim. I've never seen you take a glass before.
No, I don't when I'm fighting, Sir John, or when I've got a man in training. I like to set him a good example, but now it's all over.
Not quite, Mr. Belcher, not till tomorrow. And may the best man win.
Yeah. I ask no better, Mr. Jackson.
Right.
Sir Charles, you're just in time to join us.
We've been expecting you, Tregellis. There's a devilled blade bone ordered. I was delayed on the road.
What's the latest from London, Sir Charles? What's the meaning of these long odds against your man?
Excuse me, gentlemen. I shall be happy to give you any information in my power a little later. But now I have a matter of some slight importance to decide. Jim, a word with you apart.
Of course, Sir Charles.
How's Jim Harrison?
Jim? Never better, sir. I did him likely in the matter of exercise. Clubs, dumbbells, walking, half an hour with the mufflers. Ah, looks a picture. Fit to fight for a kingdom. He'll do his proud tomorrow, sir. For I'm a Dutchman.
Thank God. Where is he?
I've just gone to his room, sir. I felt he should have a clear 12 hours sleep before fighting.
You notice nothing wrong?
Wrong? No, sir.
No suspicious characters about.
Well, if there are, I have no chance of getting near him. I haven't left him above 10 minutes myself, and I should be going straight back.
You've set me mind at rest, Jim. Thank you.
But what's the miss with the betting, sir? If I hadn't known he was straight as a line, I'd have thought he was planning a cross and laying against himself.
That's why I hurried down, Jim. I've information. There's a plot to cripple him.
Cripple him?
Break his arm, so I heard. And the rogues are so sure of their success, they're prepared to lay anything against his appearing.
Who told you, sir?
Bill Waugh. He came to see me today.
Well, what Bill Waugh says is straight and worth taking notice of.
So I thought.
But I can assure you Jim is safe, sir. Though it might be as well for one or two of us to stand guard on his room tonight.
Could I stay, sir, with Jim?
It seems a pity to wake him since everything is all right.
Well, he'll hardly be asleep yet, sir. All this racket. I'll show you the way.
Come and have a drink with us, Tregellis.
I'll join you in a moment.
Wonder what's up with Tregellis. Looked rattled when he came in.
No, this extraordinary bet is enough to alarm anybody. I can't understand it.
10-1, Grant Wilson! Move it! 10-1!
Just listen to that. It's fantastic. There's something devilish odd going on. Mark my word.
This way. This is his room, Sir Charles. And mine is next door. Jim, here's Sir Charles Tregellis. Come to see you. Jim? Jim, where the devil are you?
Oh, no. It seems we're too late.
That's his cap, sir. Where in the world could he have gone with his head bare? I left him here not 10 minutes ago.
His bed's not even been touched.
The window is wide open.
Jim! Jim!
Oh, it's useless to call him. Those wretches will have done their work only too well.
They might trace them, sir, and find him. I can climb out of the window.
Hand me that lamp, Mr. Stone. Thanks. Now, let's have a look.
The landlord and one or two of the Corinthians from the bar parlor had followed us to the back of the house. Someone had opened the side door, and we found ourselves in the kitchen garden, where, clustering upon the gravel path, we were able to hold the lamp over the soft, newly turned earth which lay between us and the window.
See, there are footmarks here, sir. Look, it is footmarks. Oh. He wore his running shoes tonight. You can see the print. Your uncle never forgive me for this, Mr. Stone. Though I took such care of him, you'd never believe.
There's another footmark here.
Aye. Your uncle said there were four of them.
But this isn't a man's footprint, it's a woman's.
You're right, Mr. Stone. Sir Charles, look at this. A woman's footprint.
Did he know some woman in the village?
No, sir, he didn't. Yet somebody came here tonight, that's certain.
I think it's plain enough. These villains used a woman as their decoy. She came up here to summon him, and he followed her.
Look, sir, let's divide and search in different directions.
Yes.
Landlord?
Aye?
Is there another way out of here? Well, there's only one path out of the garden, sir, run by the stables. Mr. Stone, you and I will look down there.
Yes.
Come on. But my hostler might have seen something, sir.
Your hostler?
Yeah, I give him a shout. Bill! Bill! Now, what can have happened to the lad? Bill!
Come on, master.
Come here a minute.
Yes?
How long have you been by the stables?
Well, I've been in and out of them this hour back. Hey, look, we can't pack in another horse, master. Stables are bone full, and I don't hardly give them their feeds, because if they was to thicken out...
Yes, never mind that. Have you seen anyone pass down here to the lane?
Oh, yes. There was a fellow loitering about some time ago. He was walking all round the inn and peeping in at the windows.
Did you see his face?
Not proper, Governor. I turned the stable lantern on him, but he ducked. I could only swear to his red head.
What? Does that mean anything to you, sir?
Yes. What became of this man?
He slouched off, sir. And that was the last I saw of him.
You saw nothing else? You didn't, for example, see a man and a woman pass down the lane together?
No, sir.
Nor see or hear anything unusual?
No, sir. Well, that's to say I didn't see anything. But there was something I heard.
What?
It was a kind of cry, sir. Out yonder. As if somebody was hurt. And then I heard somebody driving very fast down the road to London. I remember thinking how strange it was that anyone should be driving away from Crawley on a great night like this.
Sir Charles! Sir Charles! We found this.
A cudgel?
It was in the lane, sir. And there are some wheel marks where a vehicle's been driven away.
War said they had a weapon.
It has blood on it, sir.
Yes. I fear, Jim, there'll be no fight tomorrow.
All through that weary night, my uncle and I, with Belcher and Craven and a dozen of the Corinthians, searched the countryside for some trace of our missing man. But save for that ill-boding splash upon the road, not the slightest clue could be obtained as to what had befallen him. No one had seen or heard anything of him, and the single cry in the night of which the ostler told us was the only indication of the tragedy which had taken place. In small parties we scoured the country, and the sun had been long over the horizon before we found ourselves back at Crawley once more with heavy hearts and tired feet. My uncle, who had driven to Reigate in the hope of gaining some intelligence, did not return until past 7 o'clock, and a glance at his face gave us the same black news which he gathered from ours. We held a council around our dismal breakfast table, to which Mr. Craven was invited as a man of sound wisdom and large experience in matters of sport. Belcher was half frenzied by this sudden ending of all the pains which he had taken in the training, and could only rave out threats at Burks and his companions with terrible menaces as to what he would do when he met them. My uncle sat grave and thoughtful, eating nothing and drumming his fingers upon the table, while my heart was heavy within me, and I could have sunk my face into my hands and burst into tears as I thought how powerless I was to aid my friend.
I wish we'd eat some breakfast, Uncle.
Mm. Is it likely, in the circumstance?
Let's see. The fight's at 10, isn't it?
It was to have been, Craven.
I dare say it will be.
I'll never say die, Tregennis. Your man still has an hour in which to come back.
Those wretches will have done their work too well for that, I fear.
If only they'd let me take his place, sir.
even with one arm strapped behind me.
No, that's out of the question, Jem. You're the wrong age and weight.
But it was all my fault.
I'm afraid that'll hardly weigh with Sir Lothian Hume.
You don't think they could have killed Jim, do you, sir?
No, nephew, I don't. They wouldn't risk a murder charge. They'll simply have done insufficient injury to prevent him from fighting.
It's this woman business I can't understand.
Well, she brought some hard luck story, I dare say, such as a gallant young man could scarcely refuse to listen to, and he fell into the trap.
He'd hardly be likely to go off with a stranger on the night before his big chance.
Ah, she may never have been a stranger. You know him well, nephew. Do you know of any young woman who has an influence over him?
No, there was nobody.
Well, it seems we get no further. We've searched everywhere, and there's no trace of him.
But I should advise you to go to the ringside, nevertheless. You should hold on to the last moment in the hope of his turning up.
Oh, I mean to. And I shall also protest against paying the wager under such circumstances.
It was play or pay, you know. I think the decision would go against you.
Listen to that.
What did he say?
It's the betting. Listen.
Even money, Harris. I'm talking even money. Sir Charles's man.
Even money on my man?
There's somebody knows something, sir. And we've got a right to know what it is. Landlord? Landlord?
Coming, sir.
Yeah. What's this about, the change in the betting?
Have you heard anything?
Oh, well, it's him, sir. Him has just done it.
Who?
That fellow, sir, that lies dead drunk in the passage.
What?
What?
Who?
I'm going to have a look at this.
He drove in at 6 o'clock this morning, sir. Started laying any amount of money on your man, Sir Charles. He brought the price right down.
Do you know who he is?
He's a stranger to me, sir. All I know is he's been pouring brandy down like water ever since he arrived.
I think I know him, Uncle. It's John Cummings of the Friar's Oak Inn.
What the deuce can he know about it?
Nothing, probably. He's backing young Jim because he knows him. Because he's more brandy than sense, that's all.
He was as sober as a judge when he drove in this morning, sir.
Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings, wake up. Come on.
Save your efforts, nephew. That man's out for the rest of the day.
Are we ready to start?
How much time have I left, Craven?
40 minutes.
40 minutes. Well, I suppose it's time we thought of going up to the Downs. Jem, would you be so good as to ask them to bring the caracal round?
Sir Charles, if there was only something I could do.
There's nothing, Jem. I wish there were.
Now, what do you want, Mendoza?
I'm to give the office, Mr. Craven. I was to tell Sir Charles the site is down the Grinstead Road, half a mile to the left.
Thank you.
You haven't got your man with you, Sir Charles?
What's that to you, Mendoza?
It's a good deal to all of us, Jem. There's some funny stories going about.
Then keep them to yourself, or you may wish you'd never heard them.
All right, Jem, no offence. Your breakfast don't seem to have agreed with you this morning. You know the way, then, Sir Charles?
Yes, thank you.
I'll get your curricle, Sir Charles.
I'm to be referee, Sir Charles, and Jackson is timekeeper. May I say, I hope all goes well with you, Tregellis.
Thank you, Craven. Well, nephew, how do I look? I hope nothing in my appearance betrays the fact that I'm about to lose a considerable, I might even say an enormous sum.
You look the same as always, sir.
I'm glad of that. If this is to be my last kick, it shall at least be with a well-polished boot.
Will it be very bad for you, sir?
If I'm so foolish as to gamble, I must take the consequences. Did your mother ever warn you against gambling, nephew?
She made me promise never to.
She was wise. And if by any miraculous chance I should come out of this, I shall forswear it. Boxing's a great and noble sport, nephew, but like the turf, it's ruined and degraded by the blackguards that infest it.
By the watch, we have a little over half an hour.
I think a glass of brandy before I go. Is that the caracal?
I'll see.
No, sir. I think it's Sir Lothian Hume's.
What? He dares to come here after hiring his ruffians to cripple my man?
We've no proof that he did, sir.
I know Sir Lothian, and I know his circumstances. If I have a horsewhip here,
good morning, Sir Charles. I saw your caracal outside and stopped. If you'd care to, we might drive to the ground together. Where's your man, by the way?
I might ask you that question, Sir Lothian. Where is my man?
What do you mean by asking me such a question?
Because I have reason to believe you know where he is.
If you'd kindly express yourself a little more clearly, there might be some possibility of your understanding you.
There's been a conspiracy to maim or kidnap my man, and I've reason to believe it was your doing.
I see. Your man hasn't come on as well as you hoped in his training. So you're inventing this excuse to evade your wager.
How dare you?
But you should have invented a more probable one. Or at least one which would have had less serious consequences.
Sir, you're a liar. How great a liar. No one knows but yourself.
It hardly becomes our position to quarrel like two yokels at a fair. We shall go into this matter afterwards.
I promise you, we shall.
Meantime, I hold you to the terms of your wager. Unless you produce your man by 10 o'clock, I claim the match.
I have my duty to do. Are they in here? But, officer, surely you can blink an eye. People have come for miles.
Are you two gentlemen, Sir Charles Tregellis and Sir Lillian Hume?
Yes.
I am the magistrate in this county, gentlemen, and I have information that a boxing match is to be held on Crawley Down this morning.
That is so.
Now, you know very well, sir, that such a thing is illegal.
Well, who cares about that? It's done all the time.
I care about it, sir. It may be done all the time in other counties, but I'm determined it shall not take place on any ground over which I have jurisdiction.
I presume you have a warrant, sir.
Yes, sir, I have a warrant.
Then I have a legal right to inspect it.
Oh, by all means, sir.
This seems to be correct, Sir Charles.
It is entirely correct. And to prevent waste of your valuable time, gentlemen, I may say once and for all that no fight shall, under any circumstances, be brought off in this county. I am prepared to follow you all day in order to prevent it.
Just as you hoped, Sir Charles. Might I venture to inquire whether you had a hand in this?
Is there no other place we could go to?
7 miles to the Hampshire border and 2 into Surrey.
If I might venture to suggest it, gentlemen, make for the Hampshire line. Sir James Ford on the Surrey border has as great an objection to such assemblies as I have. Mr. Merridew of Hampshire, however, has fewer scruples upon the point.
We're very much obliged to you, sir. Sir Charles, Sir Lothian, you agree to the change of site?
Of course. By all means.
The fight, then, gentlemen, will begin at 12 o'clock to allow time for the journey and set up the ring.
I'll go ahead and tell him.
Your man is here, Sir Lothian.
And my 4 in hand outside. Are you coming, Sir Charles?
In a moment, Sir Lothian.
Are we to go ahead as if 4 were well, Sir Charles?
Of course. What else? Go and help them, Jim.
I'll do that, sir.
You had a chance to be off this way, Judge Tregellis, or at least to gain time. Why didn't you take it?
Would you have done that, Craven?
I'd have been sorely tempted. You take it like a man, Tregellis. I honor you.
Can Jim come now, do you think, nephew?
I don't know, sir. I only know Jim wouldn't have let you down like this for all the world if he could have helped it.
I hope not. 2 hours to go. I think before we start, I'll take another brandy.
With heavy hearts, we started towards the Hampshire border, close upon 9 o'clock. And by that time, my uncle's curricle was almost the only vehicle left in the village street. The night before, the vehicles had lain with their wheels interlocking, as thick as they could fit, from the old church to the Crawley Elm, spanning the road 5 deep for a good half mile in length. Now the grey village street lay before us, almost deserted save by a few women and children. Men, horses, carriages, all were gone. My uncle drew on his driving gloves and arranged his costume with punctilious neatness. But I observed that he glanced up and down the road with a haggard and yet expectant eye before he took his seat. I sat behind with Belcher, while Craven took the place beside him. The road from Crawley curves gently upwards to the heather-clad plateau, which extends for many miles in every direction. Strings of pedestrians, most of them so weary and dust-covered that it was evident that they had walked the 30 miles from London during the night, were plodding along by the sides of the road or trailing over the long, mottled slopes of the moorland. Suddenly we heard a sound like the waves upon a beach, long before we came in sight of that mighty multitude. And then, at last, on a sudden dip of the road, we saw it lying before us, a whirlpool of humanity, with an open vortex in the centre. All round, the thousands of carriages and horses were dotted over the moor, and the slopes were gay with tents and booths. A spot had been chosen for the ring, where a great basin had been hollowed out in the ground, so that all round that natural amphitheatre, a crowd of 30,000 people could see very well what was going on in the centre. We had no sooner crossed the border into Hampshire than the magistrate who had prevented the contest to Crawley galloped up beside our curricle.
Sir, forgive me, but a thought has just occurred to me. My jurisdiction ends at that ditch yonder.
So?
To save you a further journey, sir, I fancy you could hardly wish for a better place for a mill than that sloping field yonder. I'm quite sure no one will interfere with you there.
What's going on, Tregellis?
This gentleman suggests the place for the fight could be that field yonder.
Ah, it's certainly suitable, and the slope provides a good view for all. I take it you agree, Tregellis?
Yes.
I'll speak to Sir Lothian.
I trust I've been of assistance, sir. I must say I'm very anxious to see the fight myself.
Does this mean they'll put the fight back to its original time, sir?
I fear it does, nephew.
Oh.
We have a little over half an hour left.
Word of the new site had spread like a forest fire. At the bottom of the slope, the ring was being set up. White wooden posts, each with the PC of the pugilistic club printed upon it, were so fixed as to leave a square of 24 feet within the roped enclosure, while outside this ring, an outer one was pitched, 8 feet separating the two. This last was for privileged individuals of whom, through being in my uncle's company, I was one. Standing up on our curricle, we could see the cavalcade approaching over the downs. In front came a huge yellow barouche, in which sat Sir Lothian Hume, Crab Wilson, and Captain Barclay, his trainer. The postillions were flying canary-yellow ribbons from their caps, those being the colours under which Wilson was to fight. Behind the carriage there rode 100 or more noblemen and gentlemen of the West Country. And then a line of gigs, tilburies, and carriages wound away down the Grinstead Road as far as our eyes could follow it.
The ring is ready, Tregellis.
Thank you, Craven.
It's my duty to tell you that barely 5 minutes remain to you.
I'm aware of it, thank you. Nephew, we'd better go to the ringside.
I should warn you, too, that the crowd looks like getting unpleasant. Some of them look ugly. There's a rumor going round that you mean to be off the match.
If an announcement has to be made, I shall do it. No sign of him, Jim.
No, sir. I think it's all up with us.
It is Grant Wilson!
There's Salonian's man. He looks good, I must say.
The young West Countryman had just emerged from his dressing tent. He was nude to the waist, with a pair of white calico drawers, white silk stockings, and running shoes. Round his middle was the canary-coloured sash, and ribbons of the same colour fluttered from his knees. He carried a high white hat in his hand, and running down the lane, which had been kept open through the crowd to allow persons to reach the ring, he threw the hat high into the air so that it fell within the staked enclosure. Then, with a double spring, he cleared the outer and inner line of rope and stood with his arms folded in the centre.
What do you think, young man? He's quite admirable, Sir Lothian. He deserves a better patron.
I've one score already to settle with you, Sir Charles. We shall remember that when we come to square our accounts. 10 o'clock. Time's up. The match is forfeit.
Time is not up, Sir Lothian. There are still 30 seconds to go.
Where's your man, Sir Charles?
15 seconds.
I was watching Mr. Craven's hand come creeping up to announce the expiry of the time when suddenly an old black hat spun over the heads of the crowd and landed in the ring, and I could see someone struggling to push through the sea of bodies.
Uncle, look, he's here!
Saved by Jupiter, saved!
Or... I fancy, Craven, this isn't enough.
Too late. Time's up.
No,
it was still 5 seconds to an hour when the hat was thrown into the ring. The fight will now proceed.
Uncle, it's not Jim, it's Mr. Harrison.
He's right. Blow me if it ain't old Jack Harrison, the ex-champ himself.
I'm right sorry to be so late, Sir Charles, but I couldn't make it straight with the missus, sir, so I had to bring her with me, and we argued it out on the way. I'll just get shut of me greatcoat and put your colours on, sir.
5 minutes, grace, Sir Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Craven. I couldn't be more glad to see you, Harrison. But what in the world brings you here?
But, sir, I sent you a message. I was coming.
By whom?
John Cummings, the landlord of the Friar's Oak Inn.
We saw him here, Mr. Harrison, but he was drunk and couldn't speak a word.
Dang me if I wasn't afraid of that. He brought a bag of sovereigns to back me with and a note from Jim for you, sir.
But what's happened to Jim?
He couldn't come through no fault of his own. And I had orders to take his place from the only man on earth whose word I've never disobeyed.
Yes, and you can make the most of it this time, Sir Charles. For never again shall you have my Jack. Not if you went on your bended knees to me.
She's not a patron of sport, sir, and that's a fact.
Sport? Sport? Tell me when it's all over.
Is your man ready, Sir Charles?
All ready, sir. I'll dress before I come.
Mr. Craven. I beg to lodge a formal protest against these proceedings.
On what grounds, Sir Lothian?
This man is not the original nominee of Sir Charles Tregennis.
I never named my man, as you're aware.
It was understood Jim Harrison was to be my man's opponent. Now, at the last minute, he's withdrawn and another and more formidable man is put in his place.
How old are you, Harrison?
41 next month, sir.
Wait.
39, sir.
Harrison is within the age and weight limit set by your wager, and I now direct the fight to proceed.
Thank you.
Good luck, Mr. Harrison.
Thank you, Master Rodney. I'll do me best for you, Sir Charles.
I know you will, Harrison.
You've a chance now, Uncle.
Yes, sir. A great chance.
I watched the two men enter the ring with a swelling heart. The Smith now sporting the blue and black colors of my uncle. I'd often looked upon his mighty arms and neck, but I'd never before seen him stripped to the waist or understood the marvelous symmetry of development which had made him in his youth the favorite model of the London sculptors. There was none of that white, sleek skin and shimmering play of sinew which made Wilson a beautiful picture, but in its stead there was a rugged grandeur of knotted and tangled muscle, as though the roots of some old tree were writhing from breast to shoulder and from shoulder to elbow. His huge, bare hands looked like two of his own hammers. Even in repose, the sun threw shadows from the curves of his skin. But when he exerted himself, every muscle bunched itself up, distinct and hard, breaking his whole trunk into gnarled knots of sinew. His skin on face and body was darker and harsher than that of his youthful antagonist. But he looked tougher and harder, an effect which was increased by the somber color of his stockings and breeches. He entered the ring sucking a lemon, with Jem Belcher and Caleb Baldwin, the coster, at his heels. Strolling across to the post, he tied his blue handkerchief over the West Countryman's yellow.
Gentlemen! Silence, please! I am requested to inform you that Sir Charles Tregellis's nominee is Jack Harrison, fighting at 13-8. Sir Lothian Hume's man is Crab Wilson, fighting at 13-3. No person to be allowed inside the inner ropes save the timekeeper and the referee. And I have only to ask that if the occasion should require it, you will all give me your assistance to keep the ground clear, to prevent confusion, and ensure a fair fight. All ready, gentlemen, and time!
There was a breathless hush as Harrison, Wilson, Belcher, and Dutch Sam walked very briskly into the center of the ring. The two men shook hands, whilst their seconds did the same, the four hands crossing each other. Then the seconds dropped back, and the two champions stood toe to toe with their hands up. As long as I live, I shall never again see such a fight as that between Champion Harrison and Crab Wilson. It was a match of youth against experience. Thirty rounds were fought in an hour and 25 minutes, and both men were beginning to show signs of wear. Harrison's breath was coming hard, and there were crimson blotches on Wilson's body where the Smith's blows had told. Yet, at the call of time, both men sprang from their second's knees with laughter upon their mutilated faces and a jest on their bleeding lips, with the determination to fight on until they could fight no more.
How is it with you, Harrison?
Oh, hearty as a back, Sir Charles. Right as a dicer.
Time!
The strain had gone from my uncle's face, but a change had come over the face of Sir Lothian Hume. It was plain that he feared his fortunes as well as his champion were going down before the smashing blows of the older prizefighter.
Get his pepper box, old partner.
Follow with the left, Jack. There's the time. Oh, good man.
Go on, Harrison, go on.
Get under his reach, Crab.
Wilson's down.
Yes, Wilson.
Oh, bravo, Mr. Harrison. Oh, Uncle, wasn't that great?
Harrison is a splendid man indeed, nephew. By George, Belcher himself never put in a greater rally. What do you think now, Sir Lothian?
I don't believe my man can lose. It was a slip rather than a knockdown.
Well, he's been slipping a good bit then, that's all I can say. Good man, Harrison, keep it up!
Your man's making a great fight of it, Sir Charles, but he should try and get in a finishing blow. 31 rounds are too many for a man of his age.
Harrison will fight while there's breath in his body.
I don't doubt it, but Wilson will have breath for longer. Your man shall try to bring it to a close.
Time!
Go on, Harrison! Go on, Harrison! Come on, Harrison!
Uncle?
Yes? Oh, good man, Harrison.
Uncle, I think Sir Lothian Hume is making a signal to someone.
What? What the deuce is he doing?
That man in the back there, I'm sure he was making a sign to him.
There's nothing he can do, nephew. He may try to bump me in the winnings, but win this fight he can't. Oh, go on, Harrison, go on.
Wilson, no! Wilson, no!
Smith has it all!
As I watched the two bruised and battered men preparing to come up for yet another grueling round, I thought of Mrs. Harrison, waiting while her man fought his last battle. I think at that moment I knew something of what she must have felt in the long vigils she had spent during his fighting career. Round after round had ended by Crab Wilson going down, and it was evident, even to my inexperienced eyes, that he was weakening rapidly. He leaned heavily upon the 2 seconds when they led him to his corner, and he reeled when their support was withdrawn. Yet his science had, through long practice, become an automatic thing with him, so that he stopped and hit with less power, but with as great accuracy as ever. Even now, a casual observer might have thought that he had the best of the battle, for the Smith was far the more terribly marked. But there was a wild stare in the West countryman's eyes, and a strange catch in his breathing, which told us that it is not the most dangerous blow which shows upon the surface. A heavy cross buttock at the end of the 31st round shook the breath from his body, and he came up for the next round with the same jaunty gallantry as ever, but with the dazed expression of a man whose wind has been utterly smashed.
Wade in on him, Jack. He's got the roly-polies now. You're doing it all your own way.
It's a shame to let the brave fellow fight on. Take him away!
Sir Lothian, as Wilson's patron, I think you should direct the sponge to be thrown up.
You think you can't win?
He's hopelessly beaten.
I disagree. I think he can fight another 10 rounds.
He'll fight no more than this one. Look at that! Sir Lothian, you must stop him.
The Smith had driven Wilson to the ropes, where he hung helplessly, almost powerless to stop the rain of blows from Harrison's iron hands. I stole a look at Sir Lothian and saw him turn slightly, raising an arm in signal to a tall man at the back. Instantly, I heard the man shout,
"Cut the ropes! Break the ring! Fair play for Gloucester!"
Hey, stay back there! Beat us! Drive these men back!
Stop them! They're trying to break the ropes!
Drive them back!
It was useless. The surge of men pressed forward in spite of the beaters out laying about them with their whips and the seconds trying to protect their men still fighting in the ring. The inner ropes snapped like threads, and in an instant the ring was a swirling, seething mass of figures, whips and sticks falling and clattering, whilst face to face, in the middle of it all, so wedged that they could neither advance nor retreat, the Smith and the West Countrymen continued their long, drawn-out battle.
The ring's broken! I appeal to the referee! The fight's null and void!
This is your doing, Sir Lillian.
We shall have to declare war, Sir Charles.
My man has the fight in hand.
I can't help that. The ring's broken. Do you consent to a draw, Sir Lillian?
Yes, no.
There's no help for it, I'm afraid. Gentlemen, silence if you please. Belcher, can you do something?
Listen, you lot! Do you want my fists and Mendoza's at your jaws? If so, you can have
it! Stop them, Mr. Craven.
Thank you, Jim. Gentlemen, as referee, I declare this fight a draw. The men are to be withdrawn and all stakes returned to their owners. Get your men away.
Come on, old timer. It's all over now.
Well, I can't say I'm sorry, Jim. Thanks for the way you looked after me.
Are you all right, Mr. Harrison?
I can stand, Master Rodney. And there's no bones broken. But I'll be glad of a good sit-down after this, I can tell you.
Come with me, Harrison. Oh, we'll have you attended. Then I'll drive you home.
Oh, that's all right, Sir Charles. Me and the missus came in a trap.
Oh, Jack! Oh, Jack!
Now, old girl, don't take on so.
Oh.
I've come back safe and sound again, haven't I?
Safe and sound? Why, it's worse than when you beat Black Baruch.
Oh, yeah.
If it weren't for your greatcoat, I couldn't swear you were the man who led me to the altar.
Oh, come.
Don't you dare ever ask my leave to fight again, Jack Harrison. If the King of England were to ask you, I'd never let you do it more.
Oh, no, this is my last fight, Lance. I'll give you my Debbie.
Give him a drink from the flask, Jim.
Here you are, old Spark.
Oh, thank you.
This will put new life into you.
Oh, thanks, Sir Charles.
Oh, you fought a great fight, Jack. Wish I'd seen you in your young days.
Oh, don't you go encouraging him. He's done with it. You heard him say so.
I'll get fresh water in another towel. We'll clean you up a bit.
Oh.
Now, let's try and settle this matter about Jim. Did you see he sent a note to me?
Yes, that's right, Sir Charles. My old woman will bear me out.
Yes, by John Cummings, sir. The landlord of the Friar's Oak Inn with instructions to bring it to you right away.
Bless me, if this isn't him now. Well, John Cummings, what have you got to say for yourself? Didn't I tell you not to let a drop pass your lips till you're giving a message to Sir Charles?
Oh, I know, Jack. I know. I ought to be poleaxed, I ought. But I did ask you, Sir Charles, as soon as I arrived, but you weren't there.
That was out searching for the man. But you could have waited.
Oh, wait, I did, sir. I take my oath. But you were so long a coming, and, well, what with the landlord here wanting me to try his own specials, and me being so pleased to have a bag of sovereigns to back Jack Harrison with, I let my senses go clean away from me.
Well, have you still got that note, John Cummings? Or have you lost that too?
No, I have it here, Jack. It's for you, Sir Charles. From young Jim Harrison himself.
Ah. Well, this is extraordinary.
What does it say, Uncle?
When this reaches you, come as soon as you can to Cliff Royal. You'll see me there and hear much that concerns you deeply. Until then, I remain him whom you knew as Jim Harrison. What do you think of that, Neville?
I don't know, sir. I don't understand it at all.
Did Jim give you this himself, Cummings?
He did, sir. Oh, I scarcely knew him at first. He looked like his own ghost. He was so eager it should reach you that he wouldn't leave me till the horse was harnessed and me started on my way. There was one note for you and one for Sir Lothian Hume. I'll give it to him outside just now.
But what should he be doing at Cliff Royal? And why does he sign himself him whom you knew as Jim Harrison?
Do you know Mr. Harrison?
I've said nothing, Master Rodney. Neither do you nor Sir Charles. I can only advise you to drive over to Cliff Royal
Well, you will find out.
I don't move till I've seen you safely in the hands of the surgeon, Harrison.
Horsey's taken good care of, Sir Charles.
Yes, Jim.
I won't leave him till I know for certain he's come to no harm.
Thank you, Jim. I shall come and see you at your smithy, Harrison.
Sir?
You shan't be the loser for what you did today. Come, nephew.
And I'll see Sir Charles when he comes, Jack Harrison.
Oh, no.
I wouldn't trust you and him together for untold gold. Why, before long, he'd be persuading my man to meet you, Jim Belcher.
If he were my age and weight, I'd be proud to, Mrs. Harrison. Come on, old timer.
Right.
Let me mop you up a bit. Then you've got to see a surgeon, or I must answer to Sir Charles.
Yeah, and I'm coming with you. And as for you, John Cummings, if I was your wife, you'd get the rough side of my tongue. Drunk, when you had an important message to deliver.
Seems a long time since we first travelled this road together, nephew.
Yes, sir, it does. And yet it's barely 2 months. I seem to have seen and learnt so much.
I, too, have learnt something today. This ends the connection with the ring. Never again do I give countenance to a prize fight. I see no possible means by which it can be kept free from roguery. Do I hear something travelling behind us?
Sir?
Look round, nephew.
It's Sir Lothian Hume's carriage. John Cummings said he had a letter as well.
Ah, yes. He's also bound for Cliff Royal. He and I are two survivors of that black night of the murder.
But why should Jim, of all people, call you there?
Why, indeed. I've had an eventful life, nephew. Somehow I feel the strangest scene of it all is waiting for me now at Cliff Royal.
That was part 3 of Rodney Stone by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, with Sean Arnold as Rodney Stone, Henry Stamper as Champ Harrison, Charlotte Mitchell as Mrs. Harrison, and John Rye as Sir Charles Tregennis. Sir Lothian Hume was played by Nigel Graham, Sir John Lade by Adrian Egan, Jem Belcher by David Sinclair, Gentleman Jackson by Steve Hodson, John Cummings and Bill War by Peter Wickham, Mendoza and Lorimer by Timothy Bateson, and Barclay Craven by David Peart. James Kerry played the part of the landlord, Alex Jennings the ostler, and Peter Tuddenham the gentleman and servant. The director was David Johnston.